We don't always see it coming, but sometimes we experience things that connect us to others in ways that we would have never imagined. The connection may not be apparent at the time, but it's there, or it will be. A connection between times that were and the times they'll become. Some physicists say that time can fold so that, theoretically, two separate moments in time can actually touch. In my experience, it's more than a theory. For me, two such moments destined to touch began nearly 40 years ago. The time was mid-November 1979. The place, approximately 13 degrees north, 102 degrees east. It was hot, very hot, and I didn't see it coming.
A short walk and boat ride from the hotel, a decrepit Wurlitzer plays Thai music at an old bobbing boat dock and cafe. A few rough-hewn tables and benches set on heaving planks overlooking the thick brown water of the Cha Phraya. Aside from regular but brief dispatches in the newspapers and a growing number of foreign correspondents at a few of the hotels, Bangkok offers no hint of the tension and despair along Thailand's border with Cambodia. Reports say hundreds of thousands of starving Cambodian refugees have amassed along the border.
I was a young radio producer covering a story that had captured headlines around the world. A mass exodus of hundreds of thousands of Cambodians, Khmer, fleeing from years of starvation and a nightmarish tyranny under the Khmer Rouge, the ruling communist regime, and a tumultuous invasion by the Vietnamese army. Huddled under small pieces of blue tarp on a hot, dry field surrounded by barbed wire, they were dying of starvation and disease, including the children, especially the children. The world was horrified, and the camps were pitiful.
Each food station was like the rest. Hundreds of hungry people pressed tightly together, waiting for a Thai soldier to allow a few through to the food. And as you watch, you begin to notice other details, like the coughing. Even among the healthiest at Sa Kiao, respiratory disease is widespread, and almost everyone is coughing.
I was there a little more than 2 weeks, filing telephone reports by night, returning to the camps during the day. It was a sea of despair and uncertainty. What I didn't know was that these were truly the lucky ones. There had been reports of malnutrition and mass murder following the Khmer Rouge takeover of Cambodia about 4 years earlier. What nobody yet knew, not the world nor the reporters witnessing the exodus, was that in the 3 years, 8 months, and 21 days after sweeping into power, the Khmer Rouge had tortured, murdered, or overseen the starvation of about 2 million people. Of the entire population of Cambodia in 1975, when the Khmer Rouge took over, it's estimated that by 1979, as many as one in every three Cambodians had died, maybe more. Think about that. One in three, maybe more. In proportion to its population, Cambodia experienced a human catastrophe unparalleled in the 20th century. At the time, some said the Cambodian people were on the verge of extinction. After 16 days of covering the death and misery at the border, I returned home, produced a radio report, and, like most of the world, moved on. New headlines of an Iranian revolution and American hostages consumed the world. The Cambodian story was, for us, essentially over. but it wasn't. Time was folding. 36 years, 7 months, and 3 days after my return, a news report caught my attention. It said that over the weekend, a small new museum, the Khmer Legacy Museum, had opened in St. Paul, Minnesota, not far from my home. It said members of the local Khmer community wanted to commemorate their culture and history. It brought to mind the genocidal Holocaust under the Khmer Rouge, a small piece of which I had witnessed. The new museum was housed on the second floor of a modest building near the edge of downtown, maybe 2 miles away. I stared at the news report, and memories stirred. At the top of the stairs, I met Huan Hach, a Khmer man about 5'5". He wore wire-rimmed glasses and a smile that made me feel as if we had known each other for a long, long time. In a sense, we had. Soon, it was clear that the story I had covered nearly 4 decades earlier wasn't over. It had never been finished. Only part of the story had been told. Soon it became clear that 2 moments, separated by half a lifetime, were about to touch. Huan and 2 of the other Khmer I met, Sokert Seus and Peek Santo Kim, were among those who had made it to the Cambodian border camps 37 years earlier. They were among the 2 out of 3 who experienced the horror of forced labor in the fields, the murder, starvation, and terror, and who lived to tell about it.
My name is Huan Hach. I'm a Cambodian. I used to be refugees in Thailand. I was about 15 or 16. Now I'm 53 years old.
The terror of life under the Communist Party of Kampuchea, the Khmer Rouge, began on the morning of April 17th, 1975, when the central government was defeated by insurgents and Democratic Kampuchea was formed. Huan was 12 years old.
I live in a village north of Battambang City.
With a population of about 1 million people, Battambang, northeast of Phnom Penh, was the center of the country's rich agricultural region.
My village was crowded with people from the countryside.
For the preceding 5 years, Cambodia had suffered through a devastating civil war, a war between the U.S.-backed government of Lon Nol and the growing Khmer Rouge insurgency led by Pol Pot and supported by China. American support was waning. 5 years in the making, the struggle was fierce. The Khmer Rouge had come to dominate the countryside. Increasingly, towns and villages were cut off from the cities. Battambang and Phnom Penh were among them. Villages near the cities were flooded with refugees fleeing from the fighting in the countryside. Communication was difficult. Travel was virtually impossible. Roads were cut off. Even air travel became impossible. Reports from refugees in the countryside said the Khmer Rouge were killing everyone they suspected of sympathizing with the central government. Nobody knew what to believe. Nobody was sure. So Kurt and Peek Santo lived in Battambang proper. On April 17, 1975, when the government collapsed, the arrival of the Khmer Rouge came quickly. Armored vehicles and columns of fighters, mostly grim-faced boys around 16 to 18 years of age, wearing black pajama-like uniforms, sandals made from strips of tires and inner tubes. They carried every kind of weapon, but mostly AK-47s. They wore red checkered scarves around their necks and heads. Some wore Chinese-style billed caps. No! The city had been celebrating the Khmer Rouge New Year, which begins each year around the 15th of April. Within hours, what followed was a witch's brew of celebration, relief that the civil war was finally over, apprehension, then fear.
In the beginning, people thought that, oh, well, the war is done. There will be peace again.
People really rejoice because we just want that war to end.
And all of a sudden, they just appear with all the weapons, you know, and we have to get out right away.
When they force us to leave our home from the city, at that moment, I know right away that danger was there.
As soon as the Khmer Rouge, we know that they kill people, we were shocked and speechless, powerless, and we realized too late.
Almost immediately, Cambodia was a country without schools, without freedom of speech, without property, without communication. Skilled workers, doctors and teachers, military officers and government officials were all killed.
At the moment, we know that we are controlled tightly by the Khmer Rouge when they burn money. The books were torn and burned on the road. And the market was suddenly closed down. And at that moment, things just changed overnight. No more school, no more money, no more religion, no more free market. Just less than 24 hours, people were shocked. Shocked beyond describe, because it happened too fast, very, very fast.
About 4 million people, approximately one half the entire population, was forced out of the cities and into the countryside. The idea was this: the cities harbored the wealthy imperialists, capitalists, government officials, U.S. sympathizers, and all those who oppose the Khmer Revolution. Capitalism, its institutions, and the educated elite who supported them would be purged completely. The Khmer Rouge would construct a truly pure communist utopia. Cambodia, Kampuchea, would start all over. The nation would return to its agricultural roots under communism. Nothing else would be tolerated. ANCAR, the organization as it was known, knew best. It would be year zero. There were many forms of indoctrination. One was through song. Songs you were expected to learn.
After 1,000 years, the mighty Kampuchea has now liberated the people held in darkness. Because the revolutionary Kampuchean Angka is robust, it has led us to persevere together to fight against the evil capitalist regime. Revolutionary Angka understands and knows clearly the friend and enemy, knows good and bad, knows wrong and right. Revolution reveals the great prosperous road.
When we were told to leave, the soldier walked on the road with guns. People was beyond speech. We do not resist. We just take their word and go.
At the time, I was 17 years old. I lived with my family, my whole family, brother and sister, my parents, and so on. After they took my father away, so as an oldest person, except my sister, I'm second in my family. So I had to take care of my mother and brother and sister, and then put them on the cart and roll everything out of the city to our home village in Phnom Sumpok, Battambang.
We walk and carry our stuff with us, It was about like 30 miles from the city. Yeah, we walked there. We're not only our family, but there was a lot of Cambodian family that live nearby. A lot of people, they just walk out, you know, in different
ways. About 10 kilometers from the city. It's about 6 miles by walking during the hot season in Cambodia.
Under the hot April sun, typically more than 100 degrees and humid, hundreds of thousands slowly made their way to outlying villages, sometimes the villages of relatives. Sometimes they were welcomed. Sometimes their own relatives were afraid to take them in, fearful of reprisals against city dwellers and their supporters. So Kurt said they knew it was a time for revenge.
We got to our home village in that afternoon, and everybody afraid to let us stay. At the time, they know that the revenge time's coming, and especially people who live in the countryside know that the Khmer Rouge will revenge on the previous government, because they try to eliminate all classes. They try to bring everybody down to one level. We live in the city dweller. They classify us as educator. So educator must be eliminated. And also people who live in high class have to be eliminated too. That's why the former people are really, really afraid to associate with us, even though they part of our family for a long time.
Crowded into villages filled with fear and uncertainty, they waited in makeshift dwellings with no walls, maybe under a relative's hut. Then Angkar leadership arrived. Work groups were formed. Many family members were separated. Families competed with the revolution for loyalty. There were to be no more families. Men thought to be associated with the old system were told they had to be re-educated. They were taken away and executed. Later, many of their wives and family members would be killed to minimize revenge reprisals. Huan was 12. He would soon see his mother for the last time. So Kurt was 16. Peak Santo was 19.
Each family with children was separate. They have a huge meeting before they separate you. A meeting tell the mother go that direction, the father go that direction, and children in certain age. If you a young child go to that section, if you youth go that direction, they separate by age.
At first, they let us regular people or people control our each other. But later on, they send their Khmer Rouge who train to be like leader of the village, of a group or something like that, to control all over us. And so that mean at the time, if the village leader want to take anybody out to kill, they can do that too. So that's the way they control the Cambodian population.
And then they separate us. The old people like my dad have their own job to do. And for people like my age, the people my age, they put them in another group.
Peak Santo was young and strong. She would be assigned to a special traveling youth group, a kind of mobile specialty cadre. They were told they would be privileged to tackle the hardest jobs.
For my age, they call it Jalat. You know, Jalat is mean like a group of the younger people that have to sacrifice themselves to go away from home and stay with the group of the other young people. But we are the first group to make a commitment to sacrifice ourselves to do all kinds of hard job, hard work. And so we have to travel from place to place, from place to place.
The state controlled every aspect of life. The Khmer Rouge even insisted on realigning the rice fields to create the symmetrical checkerboard pattern pictured on their coat of arms. Peak Santo and her group usually worked on building irrigation canals.
They took us out to the place far away from the village, and then they ordered us to do, like, to dig the ground, make a canal, and...
Most children carry what I carry, the human manure to fertilize the land. Your body smell because you carry manure, human manure, sometimes fresh.
Our daily life is just the same routine. Go to the field. Most of the time the guy will digging the ground, and then the girl, the woman will carry the dirt that they dig from the ground and carry it to the side, and then we make like a dirt road.
Around noon or 12 noon, we came to lunch about half an hour, and we rushed to go back to the field to work again. Until 5 o'clock or 5:30, we get off from the field. If there were a moonlight, we work extra. After meal, we go back to the field. Because we get extra light from the moon, we work hard until 9 o'clock, sometimes 10 o'clock.
We have to work like from 5 in the morning to 5 in the evening, and then rest a little bit, and then like 6 o'clock, then we have to go back to work again until like midnight.
So at the time you get back to bed around 10 o'clock, you get not enough time to sleep, because you get up again at 5 o'clock in the morning. If you don't wake up, they hit you.
By the second year of the Kampuchean Revolution, famine had become a devastating reality of life in the fields. The cities were empty and the fields were desperate. Some historians say Angkor had set impossible production quotas. So, fearing for their lives, local leaders starved the workers and shipped the rice away. Food production and the entire economy was in a death spiral. Radio Phnom Penh under the Khmer Rouge described dawn at the work sites as resounding with joyful cries of peasants on their way to work. And the peasants of our cooperatives are striving to fight vigorously and without pause, day or night, to achieve the great leap forward.
The food we were given by mostly like water. A soup consists of a few grains of rice in the soup. In my group, mostly students in my age, and these students get so thin and a skeleton that no food. When we eat the water soup, we cannot complain or we cannot ask for a second. If, however, you complain about food, they kill you.
Workers were allowed to grow a few vegetables next to their hut, but to actually eat what you had grown was strictly forbidden. You were required to bring what you grew to the communal kitchen. If you were caught eating what you had grown, it was proof of betrayal to the revolution.
At around our house, we grow the potato, jam, vegetable and stuff, but if it's steal it or take it from our own garden, then they find out and, you know, they could kill you.
Sometimes when you're so hungry, you couldn't sleep. Your stomach growling all the time. So you couldn't sleep and you woke up in the middle of the night to look for anything, to look for leaf, crab, snail, and you eat snail, eat raw crab, just to fill up your stomach. When you woke up to look for food, and when you get caught, they kill you. Sometimes you escape, nobody saw you, and nobody caught you, and you come back. But most of the time, they caught you.
We sometimes, you know, we too hungry, then we have to steal our own food. But you got to be careful. If they caught you, then it cost your life.
People live in fear.
They would slash you, they hit you, they kick you to the ditch.
People cannot say anything, cannot protest against anybody or say something bad about anybody in the group or in the village. So people try to hide their own identity and also to protect themselves.
They torture you in a way that you cannot describe the pain. You were so weak. You barely lift your arm, your leg. You barely walk, and then they kill you at the ditch.
We live in fear. We cannot sleep well. We cannot think okay. You know, we have to be quiet and then do what they say.
If you do some things that's not appropriate to their revolution, they can take people out and kill them without trial.
They will say that the Anka have eyes like pineapple's eye.
At the time, people spoke less, cannot say anything.
Even at night, can't even talk. There was they call it yotir, or they call it gong chlop. Gong chlop is usually the soldier, like a FBI. They will walk from place to place, from house to house at night time. They will listen to what people say. There were some people that they tried to escape, you know, but never success. They all got caught and killed.
Another form of control, intimidation, and violence was forced marriage. Anywhere from a handful to 100 or more couples, strangers to each other, would be forced to marry in mass ceremonies, sometimes in the open fields. According to historians and personal accounts, it was an attempt to break family bonds, engineer loyalties, and create a new generation of workers loyal to the revolution.
In the Khmer Rouge regime, they will force you to get married with someone even though you never know before, never talked to them before, never know who they are, and you cannot say no. You have to marry with somebody. And then there was like a 20 couple of people, they got married at the same time, at the same place, at the same day.
Refusal often meant imprisonment, torture, or even death. The couples were coerced to spend the night together following the brief civil ceremony and consummate the marriage. Some women reported that if they refused, Khmer Rouge cadres assisted husbands in raping them. In 2014, 35 years later, a joint Cambodian-UN tribunal investigating war crimes by the Khmer Rouge began hearings on the matter. 35 years later.
It was just a nightmare, you know.
On December 25, about 9 months before I would arrive in Thailand to cover the refugee crisis, the world began to change for Huynh, So Kurt, and Peak Santo. You could say it began to change for me as well, although none of us knew it.
We hope that that all the countries and people interested in peace and stability in Southeast Asia, Asia, and the world will take every possible measure to stop the Vietnamese authorities' savage aggression against the sovereign state. The statement points out that Vietnam's attempt to annex Kampuchea by force and set up an Indochina federation under its control is a major step in pushing its own regional hegemony.
Following fighting along the long-disputed Cambodian-Vietnamese border, Vietnamese troops invaded the so-called Democratic Kampuchea. Following a 17-day battle, a large Vietnamese infantry force supported by artillery and tanks liberated the capital of Phnom Penh, sending the Khmer Rouge forces into retreat. The date was January 7, 1979. What happened next would bring me to the Cambodian border 9 months later. It would also bring Huynh, Sokurt, and Peak Santo. Although by different routes, it would bring us all.
Again, it was the infants, the smallest and weakest and least responsible for the tragedy, who suffered the most. Bathed in an eerie blue light filtering through the thin-colored plastic of the makeshift walls, four tiny babies lay near death on a bamboo table. Two were silent and motionless. Of these, one had a tube inserted in...
9 months after the invasion, the world would be horrified by the reports of exhausted, malnourished, diseased, and dying refugees attempting to flee from Cambodia into the Thai refugee camps. Standing there in the midday sun, I was trying to understand what I was seeing.
They look nearly dead.
Diarrhea, yeah. All just diarrhea and fever.
Will they live?
I can't say it.
I left shaken, struggling to believe what I'd seen, but barely able. Impressions had been coming too quickly.
4 decades later, I'd recall that at the time I didn't even know what questions to ask, at least not the important questions. What had they experienced that led to this moment? In the days following January 7, 1979, the Vietnamese moved quickly, capturing Bat Nha Bong, the second largest city. The Khmer Rouge withdrew northward into mountainous retreats near the Thai border. But it wasn't over quickly. For many months, much of the countryside was still held by the Khmer Rouge. Many Khmer remained captive in the rice fields. Some escaped to Phnom Penh and Bat Nha Bong, occupied by the Vietnamese. Firefights raged. Vietnamese supply convoys were attacked by both Khmer Rouge special forces and Khmer Rouge guerrillas. Bazookas, automatic rifle fire, artillery shelling, strafing by Vietnamese MiG-21 jets, the chaos of invaders fighting a tenacious resistance. As the fighting continued, local Khmer Rouge began to lose their grip on the rural population. Ultimately, they would hole up in the mountains and continue an insurgency for more than a decade. But in 1979, Huynh was among those for whom the Vietnamese invasion had provided an opportunity to escape. He was now 16 years old, barefoot, and trying to find his way to the border.
At that time, the Khmer Rouge broke loose because they need people to fight the Vietnamese, and they don't have time to control. So people just run. I went with a group of people. I don't know them. They don't know me. But we walk west. We don't know where the border is. The reason we move west because we look to the sun and the moon set in the west. So we walk toward the moon and we look to the star. We follow one another. It takes months to get to the west.
Whenever possible, fleeing to the border meant traveling at night. Better not to be seen.
Some people die in escape, die from the shelling, the Vietnamese and the Khmer Rouge fight, and people were killed. Sometimes people die from stepping on mine and exploded and killed.
Here's the thing about mines. To avoid them, you walk single file. You can't see them. If you were at the head of the line and you stepped on a mine, you died. It didn't always blow you to pieces. It might just blow one or both of your legs off, so you bled to death at the side of the trail. Then someone else would have to take the lead. Huynh, still a boy, was farther back in line. Up ahead, when a mine exploded, he could hear it plainly. Survivors report following trails where corpses, arms, and legs were strewn along the side.
You follow the step one another. If you misstep, you misstep on mine. Then you get hurt. Get no shoes. No shoes, just barefoot. A group of people, only a few survived.
Vietnamese troops attacked and defeated the Khmer Rouge-controlling Peak Santo's work cadre, and she was told she could return to their home in Bản Bang, now occupied by the Vietnamese.
When I came back, I said, oh, well, our life is going to get better, I hope.
Reunited with her father, sisters, and brother, she and her husband returned only to find the city had been devastated. The economy was destroyed and her former home was occupied by others. It was a liberation that led to desperation.
When we came from the countryside to the city, we have no money, we have nothing, empty hand.
At that same moment, so Kurt, under similar circumstances, found his way back to the relative safety of Bản Bang.
In a chaotic situation, people move back into the city. And because we were the city dweller, we came back to our house. But to our surprise, the Vietnamese didn't want us to go into our house. Everything was destroyed in the city.
Rumors emerged. Some people from Bản Bang had found their way to a refugee camp near the Thai border, a camp called 007. There they found goods and work supported by smugglers and Khmer Sarai warlords, Khmer freedom fighters opposed to the Khmer Rouge. Apprehensive about stories of robbery, rape, and fighting, but with almost no food, no shelter from the rains, and increasingly desperate, Peak Santo and her family ultimately decided to try to get to the border. Ahead would lie flooded flatlands, wooded plains, mountains, darkness, death, and terror.
We don't know where to go, you know, but we see people. They walk with us and they told us that they go to the camp, the 007 camp. So we kind of follow him, but, you know, because we got our father, he's old. He cannot walk fast, though. We have to make, like, a stretcher for him, and then my brother helped to carry him, and then I held my niece. She's about 15, but she's very, very skinny. She was really sick. I have to carry her.
In October, I organize, I get all of my relatives, so we march out. I was 20 years old, and we march out of Cambodia into to the border. It's a long journey, day and night. And I carry my wife, youngest brother on one side, and carry whatever that I have on the other side. So I make like a something to carry them out. And my mom was very sick, skeleton. She like skeleton and walking.
It must be in the winter time because there's a lot of water. My brother-in-law had to carry my father's, and so we just walked through the water. And then
I think probably it took us almost a full day that we passed that deep water and some dry land. Some of the bush that can cut into your foot too.
Some kinds of like a little sticky thing. It's like leech, kind of clear, not white but clear, and then it will stick to you, and then it will suck your blood.
The thing is that when you walk past that water and also get into the edge of the jungle, so that means it's very dangerous zone.
To me, one of the most fearsome things about Cambodia is the snakes. They have lots of snakes. Many of them can kill you, sometimes slowly, painfully, sometimes quickly. For example, they have all kinds of vipers, small green ones, clear ones. Some jump from trees and bite you on the head or the neck. Cambodia is also famous for cobras, monocled cobras, spitting cobras, king cobras. You've got to watch where you walk. You don't want to step on them. There's also the blue crate, the red-headed crate, banded keelbacks, the small spotted corals.
We are nervous about snake scare. But we didn't have time to watch for them or whatever. You know, we just kind of rush our way to the border. So, but then we pray all the way.
Food. Sometimes we kill animal. We eat leaf, we eat wild fruit, and we eat water, plenty of water in the jungle because we get moist from the leaf. We eat leaf too.
We pray all the way. We pray that we don't get into the mines or get into all these wild animals, a snake or leech or something like that, you know. But we were just lucky.
Peak Santo and Sokurt were nearing the border. Huon wasn't far behind. Time was starting to fold.
And normally people walk only during night time. Because during the daytime you have to face the Vietnamese border patrol and also the Khmer Rouge. If the people who scout the road tell us that it's clear to go and people march out. And I'm not talking about my family, talking about 100,000 people march out during the dark of the night to leave Cambodia.
When my brother-in-law said that we were close to the camp, we all so excited. You know, somehow we got some kind of energy, we don't know where it came from. In the meantime, the Vietnamese soldier or Vietnamese troop, they do the rocket or whatever. And my father just said, come on, go, go. You know, we got excited, got all kind of energy. I don't know where it came from, and then we just ran.
Peak Santo had made it to the camp known as 007. Not long before, Sokurt had made it to a nearby camp run by a rival Khmer Sarai group.
My mother collapsed when we arrived at the camp. And my mother-in-law very exhausted, and everybody exhausted. But we feel like we're so happy to see other refugee gather together, and we build a small hut again, you know, for family to stay. I feel like I see a little light almost at the end of the tunnel, but we're not there yet.
Okay. And now, what would be the time, approximately the date?
Probably October 1979.
So you must have been there when I was there.
Yes.
We just walked across the Thai-Cambodian border. About 50 feet back into a jungle-like area.
The Thai military had only recently allowed access to the area leading to Mok Mun, and Khmer Sarai officials were welcoming Western journalists who made their way in. After our visit at camp headquarters, we toured the village, escorted everywhere by an armed Khmer soldier, a boy about 16 years old who never smiled. The camp was an enormous collection of huts spreading nearly as far as you could see in every direction.
While I was standing there reporting, so Kurt was somewhere nearby, maybe even among the population watching curiously as the group of journalists walked through the camp. And while we were there, he was making plans to escape across the border.
2 days earlier, we were told, several shells had landed near the center of the village, wounding people near the hospital.
Rivalries between factions meant gunfire, and every now and then the Vietnamese were shelling. As far as he had come, he and his family were still surrounded by danger. The only real safety lay within Thailand. Leaving the camp was not permitted. They would have to sneak across the border and around a Thai village under the cover of darkness.
And that night we walked past that village without any check or anything at all, and hide in a Buddhist temple inside of Thailand. On the way there, we saw Thai's villager carry machine gun because they want to protect their home against the civil fighting on the border. But we just walked past them. They didn't even ask us a word. And then in the morning, during the day, United Nations sent truck to pick up a refugee. And young people like me, 20, 21 years old, they didn't let us leave the camp. But then, to my surprise, when the bus start and the monk permit us to run from his house, from his place, to get into the truck, and United Nations receive us, and United Nations bring us, the United Nations worker bring us to Khao Idan camp.
Yes, here the camp of refugee, but we have also the soldiers.
At the nearby 007 camp in the tangle of lean-tos and makeshift huts, Peak Santo was making the best of it. She had arrived maybe a week or two earlier. Food and water were scarce, but Western aid workers were trickling in, and it was bustling with commerce fed by Thai smugglers. This camp was dangerous, too. Survival was tenuous, but at least it was possible.
We got nothing. We don't have no money. We don't have no gold. People back then, they used gold, diamond, whatever, to trade for clothes, food, and everything, you know. We don't have nothing. So I grow the bean sprout and sell them for the money.
A few days later, I'd returned as the Thai government and international relief agencies had hastily opened a major new refugee holding center farther inside Thai territory. Hundreds gathered by the road, clutching bundles filled with everything from a few pieces of clothing to reed mats and charred, clanking pots and pans as they waited for buses and trucks to take them to the new camp.
So on that day, they have a truck that come and pick us up, you know, like. And then I think we was the last group of the family to go to Khao Idan.
The very next night, the Khmer Rouge attacked 007 with light arms and shelling. Nobody knows how many were killed. Just a few hours earlier, Huynh was getting close.
When we heard the commotion, we heard noise, we heard the music in the camp, we knew we were getting close. And we get there, we were pointed to, you stand there, you get food there. Around 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the morning, the Khmer Rouge attacked the camp. We hardly stay a full night in the camp, and we run again to west, run toward the Thailand border. The shooting is coming toward us. The shooting, they were AK-47, they were bazooka, mostly bazooka, so we run. The shooting were intensified. They shoot because the bullet fly just above our head.
Huan and the others found cover from the gunfire behind a termite mound.
And we run and escape and stay behind. In front of us were Khmer Rouge, and behind us were Thai soldiers.
Reporters there at the time didn't know it, but the Thai soldiers could be as deadly as the Khmer Rouge or the Vietnamese. The Thai Supreme Command were protecting the border from both Khmer Rouge insurgents and the Vietnamese military. Some Thai soldiers took advantage of the unarmed, desperate Khmer refugees, robbing, beating, raping, and sometimes killing them.
Thai not allow any Cambodian refugees set foot on Thai territory. If we set foot to Thai, they shoot us.
Suddenly, a Westerner, probably a UN refugee official, appeared by the side of a dirt road. The Vietnamese deferred to Westerners, so Huan and those around him ran toward the man, drawing close to him, proximity being their cover.
The Westerner stood there. Maybe he wanted to be a witness if any Cambodian refugee get killed or shot at. And about 7:30 or 8 o'clock, a lot of trucks came to the dirt road. We believe that he called for the truck to pick us up. And we were still on the Cambodian territory. So truck after truck, we climbed on the truck. Not too easily because we were so skinny, so skeleton. We hardly to walk up on the truck. And then the truck took us to Khao Dang.
After a little better than 2 weeks along the Thai-Cambodian border, I was heading home along with most of the other reporters. I didn't know it then, but Huan, Peak Santo, and So Kurt all had made it out of Cambodia and away from the terror. There were more hardships and uncertainties to come, of course. After arriving at Khao Dang, they lived as people without a country, behind barbed wire. The Thai government considered them illegal immigrants, awaiting relocation or forced repatriation to Cambodia. Their future was uncertain. Another thing I didn't know was that all three of them would make their way to America. Huan, the youngest, would be guided by an American couple who would inspire him to go to college in New York, where he got a master's degree. Peak Santo would remarry, move to Minnesota, and devote her life to Buddhism and Christianity. So Kurt, landing first in Kansas City, became a Christian minister, also in Minnesota. And none of us knew that we had shared a little time in 1979, in 100-degree heat, at latitude 113 degrees north, 43 degrees west. And least of all, none of us knew that we would meet again. Two moments in time, spanning nearly 40 years, had begun to touch. At first, we didn't know we had once shared a moment in the aftermath of a great disaster. We didn't know that time had folded and that the story I never finished would find a new ending. Now, what would be the time, approximately the date?
Probably October 1979.
So you must have been there when I was there.
Yes.
This is me, and you pass it to your husband. As a young man, I
was
33 years old. I'm not sure if this was at Tsikau or 007. Maybe those things look familiar to you. This is at the old camp at Mok Moon. What amazes me is that we have met now.
I think when you were there, that's, I remember during the time there also a big group of journalists came.
Yes. It was a big group of journalists and medical people. And that was November 10th.
We are right in the camp in October. So it's November, you're right. After you guys visit and the Red Cross send help.
After all those years, we discovered how our lives had once crossed paths, and now it had happened again. We'd been drawn together. For my part, it was a news article that sparked my curiosity, a distant memory and a reminder of questions I never asked that had led me up an old flight of stairs. For Huon, Sokurt, and Peak Santo, it was something more, something that sustained them when they were hopeless, drove them forward and guided them in their flight from the nightmare, something that steered them west to a border they'd never crossed and a life they had never seen but could only hope for. What is it that guides us all, that brings us together? At the time, as Huon and the others made their way through the darkness of night, they had no time to reflect. They knew only to follow the moon.